Teach Me to Code podcast, episode 19, interview with Kevin Rutherford. Hey everybody, welcome back. I have a few announcements before we get started. First off, we're doing a great interview today with Kevin Rutherford, and I'll go ahead and introduce him in a minute at the beginning of the interview. Also, next month, there's a conference coming up. It's Agile Roots Conference. It's in Salt Lake City. And in the next episode, I'm going to be talking to one of the founders of the conference named Andrew Schaefer. And, I'm really excited to be talking to him to kind of get a feel for what the conference is about and what's going on there. Also, I've set up an IRC channel in the irc.freenode.net server. It's Teach Me to Code. And if you come join the channel, I should be in there most of the day. But since I do have a day job, I may not always be able to answer your questions. If you do have a question, though, feel free to, join the channel and, chat with me. Let me know what's going on. Let me know how I can help you out. I'm really interested in connecting with you, and I hope that all works out. Also, we now have a new sponsor. It's New Relic. They're a company that does monitoring in Ruby and Rails and Java applications, and I'll go ahead and have a spot for them at the end of the podcast, so be sure to listen so that you know where to go to sign up for their service. It's terrific. They actually have a free service too, and you can sign up for that. So anyway, here's the interview. Hey everybody, this is Charles Max Wood with the Rails Coach Podcast. I'm here with Kevin Rutherford. He wrote the Refactoring in Ruby book. It has a bunch of spaghetti and a fork on the cover. It's by Addison Wesley. Kevin is also an Agile coach. He teaches people how to do test-driven development and various flavors of Agile methodologies. Is there anything else you want people to know about you, Kevin?
I think that's a fairly good summary, thanks.
All right. Well, it's interesting. I read your Refactoring in Ruby book. And I've used the Reek tool as part of the metric foo package.
Okay,
so I'm going to ask you a few questions about that, but I think the thing I'm really interested in is actually the agile practices and building software teams and things like that.
Okay.
So first off, I'm just kind of curious, where you got the idea to build something like Reek from?
Well, in my coaching practice, one of the things that I encourage teams to do is project automation. And a lot of teams are fairly new to that sort of idea, writing build scripts and deployment scripts and all that sort of stuff. And if they are completely new to it, I usually encourage them to pick up Ruby as the tool to do it in. I mean, the Ruby tool set here is extremely mature, I think, and way ahead of most other environments. So I found myself encouraging a lot of teams to learn Ruby. And at the same time, I was encouraging all of those teams to use Bill Wake's original refactoring workbook, which is a Java book. And it dawned on me that we needed a crossover of the two things. So hence the book was born. And Reek was born out of that, really, as a test bed for the ideas. So I wanted to have a way of exploring whether we got the ideas in the book right, whether we had understood really how to detect code smells and so on. So I had the idea of wondering whether I could write a static analysis tool for a dynamic language. At that time, ParseTree had just been created by Ryan Davis. And so that formed the basis of the parser. It creates syntax trees, so I was able to jump on that. So Reek was really really born out of the desire to write a good book in that sense. So I wanted to make sure that we had the ideas right, and that I knew where the edges of the smells were, and how and what was difficult about trying to detect them in Ruby. Mm-hmm. That was just over 2 years ago.
So what's the hardest part about identifying code smells from a program? I mean, you know, I read the book, Refactoring in Ruby. You know, I've heard of code smells before that and talked to a few people about this kind of thing. And it seems to me that in a lot of the cases, I mean, you look at your code and you identify things that way. Is it harder or easier in code, and what challenges did you face?
There are a couple of really difficult areas, particularly in Ruby. One is the lack of type cues. So when refactoring and code smells were conceived as ideas back in the late 90s, Martin Fowler and Kent Beck were using Java. And it's fairly easy to see that you've got primitive obsession, because your method signatures are littered with int and char and string and so on. You don't get any of that in Ruby. There's no clear type identification, and you can't do enough static analysis to know what the type of something is. So there's a whole class of smells there that are really hard to detect. And secondly, there's a whole class of smells that are to do with change. I mean, really, refactoring and code smells and so on are all about the ability of your code to support change. Mm-hmm. And some of the more global smells, like shotgun surgery, divergent change, they're actually about whether concepts are properly encapsulated in your code, and how easy the code is to change, how cohesive and coherent it is. And you can't tell that by looking at a few methods or a single class. Mm-hmm. So there's that whole class of smell that really is beyond the scope of anything like Reek at the moment, at least.
Huh, that's interesting. As interesting as code smells and refactorings are, I'm really curious about your business in agile coaching and test-driven development. First off, if somebody calls you in to help them organize their team, to build software better and you know, get things out more quickly, what kind of problems do you typically look for? What kind of practices do you look for that they're doing maybe right?
Every team's different, and I try really hard not to have preconceived ideas before I go in. With some teams, the biggest problem is that their developers are being interrupted all the time, and so they can't focus. With some teams, their biggest problem is a massive legacy database. With other teams, the biggest problem is that there's no pull from the market, so they don't know what software that they need to be writing, and so they're drifting. So the first thing I do is spend a little bit of time getting a handle on what are the most obvious problems and try and get those out of the way. That usually doesn't take very long, and usually gives quite rapid benefits. And after that, it's then on to really getting the team good at developing the right software. So understanding customer needs and breaking them down into testable thin slices of deliverable functionality, and then delivering those in a high quality and rapid manner. Hmm. So for that last one, the focus will be on test-driven development, continuous integration, mature use of version control, team working, pair programming, and all those technical practices. Whereas for the first one, it's more about analysis. It's more about figuring out what needs to be done and how it can be sliced up.
Okay.
So it's a mix of all of those things, depending on where the team has strengths and weaknesses.
Okay. Which set of practices seem to work best for you when you're coding? I mean, do you usually go with like extreme programming or Scrum, or do you kind of have your own methodology that you follow?
I guess I'm closest to extreme programming, although my teams tend not to use iterations. They tend to go for more of a Kanban style flow. I'm hesitant to say Kanban here because some of the aspects of Kanban seem a bit waterfall-y to me. So my teams end up with a non-iterative, rapid flow of features that they're producing. And within that flow, they're using XP practices.
Okay. I've also noticed that you deal with test-driven development a lot. And that's a practice that I've picked up. I think it's fairly common in the Ruby community that people do something like it if they don't do test-driven directly. You know, you have behavior-driven and a few other approaches to that. Is there anything beyond just the basic write your test first and then you write your code and then you refactor? Is there anything beyond that that you teach people to do?
At one level, it genuinely is that simple. But there are lots of different ways of writing tests. There are lots of different ways of writing the code in response to the test. And there are varying degrees of refactoring you can do. So the devil is in the detail, really. I think, for example, when writing tests, should you use the traditional TDD style of create whatever objects you need and then do something to them and then assert some state change? Or should you use the kind of sashimi mocking style where you mock out everything that the object under test is going to need to talk to so that it's totally isolated and so that you can verify that it does indeed talk to the other objects that you expect it to talk to? So there are radically differing styles of test that you can write, and that's just the first step. In the second step, everyone is encouraged to write the simplest possible code. But again, that's not as easy as it seems always. And you can go a lot further with that if you want to be very extreme. And in some cases, you can insert duplication deliberately. You can deliberately avoid creating domain concepts and so on so that the test is self-contained and then you genuinely have to refactor out those concepts later. So there's a whole bunch of different styles. And then when it comes to refactoring, the third step, you need to make sure that you've removed everything you can see, but if you're working on a legacy code base, you don't necessarily want to go too far and spend time refactoring stuff that doesn't need to change at this point. And then there's a fourth step, which everyone forgets, which is integrate.
Right.
And I tell every team that I visit for the first time that you're only integrating every few months now, but in a few weeks you'll be integrating every 10 minutes. And that's a massive culture change.
Now, when you say integrate, are you talking about things like continuous integration where you have the automated build, or are you talking about something more general than that?
Yeah, I'm saying as soon as your tests are green, commit the code so that your continuous build server can start to build it, and as soon as you've done the refactoring, commit again. So everyone gets to share everyone else's results really, really rapidly. and the build server is humming away pretty much continuously if you've got, you know, three or four pairs in the team.
Yeah, we brought our continuous integration machine to its knees. Yeah, so the idea of it humming continuously, I think, would make our systems administrators cry just a little.
Yeah.
But it's so valuable. And, you know, it's interesting to me, too, that you can also not just see if your code changes play nice with everybody else's, but you can also add other things in there like metric foo, which includes your reek tool that, you know, give you measurements on your code and help you identify problem areas. And
right.
I think it's interesting, too, that there are so many tools out there that help you do that kind of thing where, you know, they're not telling you how you need to write your code. They're just helping you identify areas that might cause you problems later. And there's so much value behind that just to catch it early while you're still thinking about it and while it's still fresh, as opposed to coming back to it, you know, 6 months down the road and going, well, why can't I make this change in 5 minutes like I think I should be able to? And then you're looking at it and going, oh, well, now I'm using the same tools, the same readout, basically, and going, okay, well, you know, this is where the problem is, and, you know, gee, I could have fixed this 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't necessarily recommend making the build fail on the basis of metrics, mm-hmm. But certainly having them publicly visible wherever possible is always a good thing. So ideally, I like to have somewhere a visible graph showing numbers of code smells, amounts of duplication, test coverage, and so on, just so that that information is in the public domain and everyone can see whether they get worse or better.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And I like teams to publish their bug counts as well. You know, if you're embarrassed about the number of bugs in your code, then that's a sure sign that you need to do something about it. And I think it's a good sign of maturity to get to the point where you're sufficiently happy with your bug counts that you're prepared to publish them, say, on your company website.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. And, you know, where I currently work for a company that aggregates crime data and puts it out there. So I think mm-hmm. that might be an interesting metric to our customers as to just how reliable our software is.
Yeah, and the other key metric that I'm interested in is cycle time. How long between someone raising a request and that request being fulfilled and in use in that person's hands, whether it's a new feature or a bug report. Mm-hmm. So what's the team's cycle time? And to me, that's the metric that drives everything. That's the one that says if we can get that down. I mean, with some teams, it starts out being 2 years. And if we can get that down to a week or less, then we know we're a pretty agile team.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, that you bring that up. I talked to Dave Thomas of the Pragmatic Programmers about 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. And it's really funny to me that, you know, I talked to some of the newer developers, and I haven't really interviewed too many newer developers on this podcast, but, you know, they talk about, like, things that you see in the code. I mean, things like these code smells and things like that. But when I talk to some of the people who are a little bit more mature in the software development community, it seems like it always comes back around to what does the customer want, how quickly can we give it to them, and with what level of quality and reliability. And then as their requirements change, how can we keep up? And it, you know, it's interesting that, you know, it becomes so much more about the customer or the business user or, you know, whatever your case is, as opposed to just writing elegant code or, you know, meeting whatever level of satisfaction you have in your quality of code. But it really comes down to that core business need.
Absolutely. I mean, the the guiding principle in all of my work is something called the theory of constraints. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a process improvement tool set developed by an Israeli physicist called Eli Goldratt. There's a fantastic book that he wrote in the 80s called The Goal, which is actually about a failing manufacturing plant and how they had to reorganize in order to turn around that plant and save the business. But the principles apply to pretty much any organization. Every organization has a goal, and everything you do should be oriented towards that goal. And in terms of software development, our goal is to automate parts of our users' daily lives. And if we're not doing that, then we're missing the point. Mm-hmm. And the whole of Agile, the whole of everything I do is geared around satisfying those customers in delivering them the software they need at the time they need it, and automating the various bits of their process. So one of the big challenges in, for me at least, in Agile coaching is to get organizations all pointing in the same direction and all being driven by that single goal. Mm-hmm. And even having people just understand that that's what the goal is can often be the catalyst that affects the transformation. Just that realization that, hey, we're here for the customer. Mm-hmm. So let's do whatever the customer needs, and let's do it fast. And as I think John Goodson said about 10 years ago on the XP mailing list, the secret to going fast in software development is not to make any mistakes.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think in general you spend more time fixing a bug in code, in a section of code, than you probably did writing it.
Yes. And another, so at the sort of at the outer level, it's all driven by the goal and by cycle time and delivering the right software and so on. And all of the things like code smells and metrics and so on are all internal measures that help the team understand whether it's doing that, and whether it's likely to be able to keep doing that, mm-hmm. whether its current pace is sustainable or whether it could be improved.
I'm kind of curious too, if you go into a team that's having some of these problems, and they begin to implement this automation, and they really start to get a handle on what their code really looks like and how it interacts with the other members of their team's code, what changes do you typically see in the code that you can recognize as maybe quality changes or key differences between kind of the more agile teams and the teams that are just trying to figure out how to make it work?
Wow. I guess one obvious thing is the amount of test coverage, and therefore just simply the number of tests. If a team don't have any tests, they can't possibly be going fast, because no matter how good they are, they will break stuff accidentally. Mm-hmm. Another thing is the size of their classes. I'm assuming that most teams are using an object-oriented language these days. Mm-hmm. But a lot of teams don't use object-oriented languages in an object-oriented way. So quite often you'll see huge classes that are effectively libraries and other little classes that are effectively just chunks of data. Huh. And if I see that, then I know that very little object-oriented design is going on, and therefore very little isolation is happening, and the code will be very difficult to change because everything will be connected to everything else.
Right. So basically these teams are abstracting the behavior from the data instead of allowing the behavior to interact with and modify the data and the state of the object.
Yeah, it's like writing C. I started professional development in the early 1980s as a C developer for 10 years. And basically all you've got are functions and structs and an awful lot of Java and .NET teams still kind of work that way. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to that extreme, but the balance in the code is not supporting future change. And so everything is tied together. Everything is coupled to everything else. And the other thing I guess is not having the little classes, the little value objects, little objects that represent money or dates or the little domain values, barcode or car registration plate. Those little value objects. Mm-hmm. If they're missing, then again, the data representations of those concepts will be littered through the code, and trying to change anything is either going to introduce bugs or just take forever. We've got some really interesting exercises in the book actually to do with data representations. A whole bunch of code smells in chapter 10 on data where the exercises there make you look very hard at, suppose you've got a street address or a date or a social security number, come up with half a dozen ways to represent each of those concepts. Mm-hmm. And then imagine each of those half a dozen ways was wrapped up as an object. And you can see instantly then that by not doing that, by not creating that little encapsulation wrapper, you're littering the code with knowledge about which representation you chose. And that knowledge will kill you in the end because it just ties all the code together. Hmm. You hear horror stories of rockets that exploded, costing tens of millions of dollars because one team used inches and another team used centimeters or something like that to represent the same concept. Mm-hmm. And when those bits of code are integrated together, disaster happens.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point some of that out. I mean, I've been watching the Railscast by Ryan Bates. And he had an episode about refactoring something in his code or debugging. And the problem was that he just had a list of tasks, and he only wanted them if they were due within the next 10 days, and it was giving him back all of his tasks. And as it turned out, what he was doing is he was doing 10.days, and he was adding it to a date. And if you add an integer to a date, it adds days rather than seconds. Mm-hmm. And so, it's that same concept where, 10.days deals with times, and he was using it to modify a date. And, wrapping that, it was a different representation of in different units, of the same concept, and recognizing that and realizing that really he only wanted to add 10 rather than add 10 days. Mm-hmm. It cleared that up. But, that kind of assumption, I guess, that you're going to make in that code, some of these things you can't avoid, but some of them you can avoid to make your code less ambiguous.
Right, and so it's just one of the things I look for is the lack of those little mm-hmm. objects. I suppose the last thing that I look for is churn. If there is the small number of source files that change a lot, mm-hmm. then I know that the chances are they're changing for multiple different reasons, and that tells me there's coupling in there.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And that's something that I saw when I was working for a company over in Provo, Utah. We had one file that when we ran our code metrics on it, its churn rate was about 10 times the rest of the file. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the code base. And it quickly became apparent that everything ran through it. Mm-hmm. And it became a real problem. We actually wound up refactoring it into like three different controllers and, you know, several views in Ruby on Rails. And, you know, yeah, it's an interesting measure of where you're placing all of your eggs, I guess, which basket mm-hmm. you put them all in.
Yes, absolutely.
So you've mentioned test-driven development a couple of times and test coverage. How much test coverage is enough test coverage? Do you believe that every project should have 100% test coverage, or does that depend on the project?
Good question. If you use something like RCov, something that counts coverage by lines of code, you can have 100% test coverage and still have bugs. Mm-hmm. Because you can have values or conditionals within a line that where every case isn't covered. Right. So 100% coverage is good to aim for, but once you get there, it's not necessarily meaningful, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. I don't always aim for 100% coverage around the edges of a system, at the places where the system interacts with other systems or bits of the real world or other services. You can't always get that because of just sometimes it's just too difficult to actually interact with other systems. So for most projects, anything above 90% coverage is a good number to be having. But I think more important is to have a team culture that says whenever we get a bug or whenever we're surprised, our immediate response to that is to write another test, mm-hmm. is to find out what was wrong and test the hell out of it so it can never come back. And I think having that mindset is far more important than worrying about what your coverage is. Mm-hmm. Because if you regression test every surprise, eventually the frequent surprises will stop happening, and you don't necessarily need this is gonna be a radical statement. You don't necessarily need 100% coverage in the bits of the system that aren't changing and don't have bugs. Mm-hmm. So particularly if you've got a code base that isn't well tested, to me it's the culture of saying we're going to test everything that breaks from now on. Uh-huh. Then you're going to be in good shape fairly soon, irrespective of what the coverage number is saying.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Well, I think we're out of time, but I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast, and I think we've really gotten excuse me. I think we've really gotten some gems out of this discussion. You know, just as far as you know, work processes and ways that we can. That we can make our coding practices better and basically do what Dave Thomas said in my interview with him, where rather than building better code, we're building code better.
And yes, absolutely.
You know, we're doing the right things, and as a result, we will have the code that we need in both the reliability and flexibility that we need to move ahead and work in these systems in the real world. I just want to recommend too that people go pick up your book, Refactoring in Ruby. It's published by Addison Wesley. Has a foreword by Brian Merrick, who is just a brilliant guy, and he encourages you to go and look at your code and make sure that you are making it better. And you know, go check out Kevin's website. It's kevinrutherford.co.uk. And he also puts a bunch of interesting stuff related to this work on his blog, and you can get there at silkandspinachallspelledout.net. So is there anything else? Any other good ways of following you? I guess Twitter? Kevin Rutherford?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, Kevin Rutherford. And if you've got any questions, there is a Reek mailing list, and all of that is available from the GitHub pages and the wiki on GitHub for Reek. And I would urge everyone, everything we've talked about today has been about practice, really, and the behavior of developers. And I would urge everyone, if you do look at the book or look at Reek, do the exercises. Practice, practice, practice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One other thing that I want to recommend, Kevin does have Reek on GitHub, which means that you can clone it, you can look at the code, and you can also submit patches. So if there's anything that you want to do to help Kevin out, or you know, even add documentation and things like that, feel free to clone it, add it, and submit a patch to Kevin, and I'm sure he'll appreciate the help.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, thanks again, and hopefully sometime I can make my way out there and we can go have lunch or something.
Cool. You're welcome in Manchester anytime.
All right.
All right. I just want to thank Kevin again for coming onto the show. And I also want to just remind everybody that this show is sponsored by New Relic. New Relic is the leading provider of application performance management tools for Ruby and Java applications. In fact, thousands of companies use New Relic RPM to monitor, troubleshoot, and optimize applications deployed either in the cloud or in dedicated hosting environments. RPM Lite is free, fully supported, unlimited time version, and it's available at www.newrelic.com. All leading Rails companies use New Relic, including 37signals, AT&T Interactive, Shopify, RStage, IGN, and a whole lot more. So go check them out, www.newrelic.com. And thanks, everyone.